It's time to get organized with Dr. Craig and Citizen Action. Working for democracy and taking on economic, racial, and environmental issues across Wisconsin and around the United States, here's Earl Ingram with Dr. Robert Craig.
Welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I am always excited with my guest that I'm getting ready to introduce to you once again. A man who really is, I can't think of anybody as unique. With all the people I know, especially in the political arena, I think my guest that I'm getting ready to reintroduce to you stands alone in just his way, his intellect, his way of expressing things, his commitment to fighting for justice. There's only one, and we're excited to have back Dr. Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action. Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm great, Earl. Always great to be with you.
You know, I said that what I wanted to do today is dedicate this time to you and Citizen Action. And I think it's important, Dr. Craig, that we get an understanding of what Citizen Action is, why organizations like yours exist, how people can get engaged and involved. If I tell you how many times I've talked to people who have given up and feel like they can't fight this battle, the battle is already lost. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you explain the kind of work that you and Citizen Action does. You know, we often talk about an army that needs to be an army to push back on things that are taking place. If I tell you how many times I've talked to people since this supposedly caving of the Democrats, people are frustrated, Dr. Craig. They're probably more frustrated than I've ever seen them. So let's talk a little bit about Citizen Action, about why you guys are able to continue to fight, how people can get engaged.
So thanks, Earl, and thanks for having me as always. And let me just start, Earl, and you should break in at any time, with the kind of organization Citizen Action Wisconsin is, that we're in a class of organization, and that would be volunteer-driven groups that are focused on common good issues. So in other words, what we're pushing for is things that improve everyone's lives, that lift all boats. We're not, there's another kind of voluntary association that's about a special interest, right? Like a group of companies will come together and try to lobby the legislature or influence political outcomes in order for their business, in order to get things, right? That is different. That is also a kind of voluntary engagement. And the kind of organization Citizen Action Wisconsin is, people don't realize, because we have kind of a thin view of democracy in our society. We think democracy is people passively listening to what candidates have to say over electronic communications and then voting, and that's democracy, and then the people decide, and then the popular will is implemented. The research actually shows that's not the case at all, that the popular will is not reflected by how elected officials vote because of the incredible role that wealthy people and very well-financed special interests have, and how they influence the political system and influence who gets elected, and especially how they affect what elected officials experience once they're in office, especially in a state legislature or in a Congress, for example. They're able to exert tremendous pressure on legislators and have them act in a special interest, not in the public interest. And if we're thinking about why democracy is so fragile and is so at risk right now, Earl, it's because there are a lot fewer people that are directly engaged. In the early part of American democracy, in the early 19th century, Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman, wrote a famous book called Democracy in America that made observations about what was unique about the first large-scale democracy in human history that had any stability. And part of what he described was this immense number of people that were engaged in everything, of civic associations, and everyone, it being a nation of joiners was his term, and everyone is a part of some multiple organizations that's pushing for various things in their communities and their states at the national level. That kind of intermediary role, active people that stand between the disengaged public and elected officials, that is what makes for healthy democracy, because only that vibrant ecosystem can make government represent the public will and its needs and not allow it to be taken over by the powerful. And when during our heyday of progressive and liberal reform in the early 20th century, in the progressive era, the Fighting Bob La Follette era, then in the New Deal with FDR, the same phenomenon has been tracked. Robert Putnam, a Harvard sociologist, has done a great deal of work to show this, and he's also shown that it's declined rapidly, starting around the 1970s in the United States. So that is part of why people are so frustrated with government and don't think it delivers anything, and why some people are walking away from it, and why now we have a whole political party that is, quite frankly, unified behind the president that wants to end most of the key features of liberal democracy that allow for a fair playing field where decisions are made democratically, moving in an authoritarian direction. But it all starts with people being disengaged. And we can talk about why they become disengaged, Earl, but I want to say that we exist and other organizations like CIS and Action with Us exist because this is the only way we'll ever create a more perfect union where we have a democratic government that works in everyone's interest, that we have true multiracial, multi-class, multi-gender democracy.
You know, Dr. Craig, one of the reasons why I especially wanted to talk about this subject this morning is because the frustration that people felt, especially once the conversation was that the Democrats caved and the as the government is going to be reopened, and just the frustration that I've been hearing from people, and they're ready to give up. But you just explained giving up means that this democracy that many of us know and are born into and love, it's fragile. It's always been fragile, and it's going to remain fragile if we aren't willing to fight for it. Is it safe to say that?
Yes, it is. And let me give you something. I'll talk more about why participation has declined as we move along the conversation, Earl, and what groups like CIS and ACTION for Us are going to try to do about it. But let me, to create hope, because you're very good, Earl, at talking about the need for hope, let me just say that what just happened with the government shutdown reflects the power of mobilized people, but it also reflects that there is a lot more work to be done. So the research is overwhelming that the way to undermine an authoritarian regime or a would-be one, someone in a government that's trying to become, move in authoritarian direction, is mass non-cooperation. They require on the voluntary assent of average people, of institutions like institutions of higher learning, businesses, other levels of government, everything else. They actually can't get a darn thing done if there isn't cooperation. People have to like actually execute what's going on. And so when Donald Trump and his regime first started simply, violating the law and taking over closing agencies that were created by Congress, had been funded by Congress, not a power the president has, right? Firing people needed to execute programs that are passed by Congress, our law, have had money appropriate to them, and had an executive order nullifying a part of the Constitution, 14th Amendment, birthright citizenship. You needed birthright citizenship to overturn Dred Scott and make African-American people, black people, citizens of this country. Their citizenship was denied before the Civil War in that Dred Scott decision. And so the Democrats at first couldn't get unity to stand up, but when they were asked to vote for a continuing resolution to fund the budget that they were not included in, even though it required their votes, they were not negotiated with, okay? They said no, and they gave a specific thing they wanted, that is, not let tax credits expire, which are going to jack up healthcare costs for Americans at a time when they're already highly unaffordable. So the Democrats doing that and doing it for over 40 days, Earl, that was because the first time they didn't do it earlier in the year, they received incredible public backlash within their own base. Because the public understood that you have to stand and fight or we will be in an authoritarian situation. So they were prompted. That's that intermediary role that active people have on the system. It could put pressure on the system if they're organized, they push in the same direction. But it wasn't quite enough because, there are so many, their Democratic Party is so diverse and there are some that are so afraid to fight that eight of them basically turned their backs on all of their colleagues and cut their own deal to bring the government open again. I would call them the Benedict Eight after Benedict Arnold, Earl. And so what do we need? We need to keep organizing and keep pushing them and then win elections. By the way, winning elections means keeping elections fair and free so when elections can be won in 2026 because the Trump regime is trying to stack Congress and that the maps by midterm gerrymandering, which is never been done before this way, to try to make it so it doesn't matter how the people vote. That's how you define authoritarianism. You win either way. Heads, you win. Tails, the other side loses. So you also win. So there's both hope in that people got very organized and pushed the Democrats to fight like they never fought before, but that we still weren't able to keep all of them the whole time. But the silver lining, Earl, is that because of information, there being so much information, Donald Trump being so good at finding a way to do something crazy each and every day and distract people, right? There's always another crazy thing happening and thing dropping, right? Like the White House being, the whole East Wing being taken down and they're replaced by a gaudy Las Vegas ballroom, things like that. And so what it did was it made people clear that at a time when Trump ran on making life affordable, then figured, that's just what I told people. Now I'm going to do what the heck I want. I'm going to do things the opposite. It made it very clear that who was taking away health care and making it unaffordable for many people who have nowhere else to go, it drove home the point. I would have preferred the Benedict Eight had not withdrawn support but quite frankly, it still served a purpose, but we need to keep pushing because the New Deal only extends the government till January 31st, so we don't know if the Democrats are going to continue to fight because they need complete unity in order to fight, because as we just saw, eight senators is enough to pass a budget right now with the composition of the Senate.
You know, Dr. Craig, what's so nauseating about this is the Republicans held tight. They didn't deviate. And so because they were willing to stick it out, come hell or high water, it didn't matter how much suffering the American people were going through, the Republicans were going to stick it out. And when I'm listening to some of that eight who have decided, well, we're going to trust the Republicans. We couldn't watch the suffering of the American people continue to go on. It made me just shiver, because they somehow said that, you know, we can't watch this. The Democrats, you know, we're the ones, we're responsible. But Dr. Craig, when you see that the cost of insurance is already skyrocketing, and I talk with people and people just, they've thrown up their hands. And I do understand partially why they've thrown up their hands. If they've lived long enough, they never believed this could have happened to the United States of America. Other nations, third world nations, yes. But the United States of America, they can't believe that this is transpiring.
Well, authoritarians rely upon our frustration, our exhaustion, our disillusionment, on the divisions in our society, because they try to find a way to divide people in order to conquer, as Scott Walker called it, divide and conquer. They actually think this way. And yet it's terrifying that you can see how unified an authoritarian party can be, how they are so afraid of the leader that they will take tremendous political damage that the other party would never take. And in fact, if they think their opponents will cave, then they're never giving in to anything. It's sort of like if the Packers knew that if they played smash route football on their opponent and the opponent would eventually give, right, and stop pushing back hard enough, then you just keep running the running back into the line until they give. You have to show that you won't give in order to get to cause a different reaction. Now, it does still create opportunities, because there's one swing district right now in Wisconsin. Russia District 1 in the southeast part of the state could be, if a candidate could emerge that could get the resources needed to actually be an effective challenger. But the one that we know that's happening is Congressional District 3 in western Wisconsin, which is Eau Claire, La Crosse, Stevens Point, and the whole area along the Mississippi River there. And Derek Van Orden is, you know, as MAGA a congressman as you could find in a swing, you know, purple district. And he looked terrible during the fight over the Medicaid cuts and looked terrible on this. So he may have walked the plank here, right? If people in that district would just keep working and make sure that he loses that election. But there lay a great deal of activism, because our organization has two chapters in that district, organizing co-ops, we call them. Large number of people have taken a lot of action in order to expose him, and he's further exposed because he's going to vote. He will not only vote to reopen the government. If he ever gets a vote on extending the tax credits for the Affordable Care Act, he will vote against it. But the key thing is for these people to have to reveal themselves to their own voters. So, but yeah, there is no alternative, because frankly, democracy has never been a spectator sport. And how much government acts in the public interest has to do with the level of people's participation beyond voting, both voting and beyond voting, in actually those who are able, those who have the time or any time at all, are actually engaged with others in voluntary groups pushing in the right direction. That is the only way, because, and here's why, Earl, because there are always powerful actors who will figure out how they can get theirs, and they can just take a bigger piece of the pie. And the term comes from feudalism. It's in economics, it's called rent seeking. And what that means is, in feudalism, it meant you get to charge rent for the land because the king gave you this land and made you a lord, right? And you get to make all of the peasants pay you in crops, right, for the use of your land that you've just gotten because you have a connection to a king. Well, that's what the health insurance companies, the hospitals, big pharmaceutical companies, they figure out a way to set up and rig the system so they can profit handsomely. The big for-profit energy utilities like We Energies, they are all like landed aristocracy. They're rent seekers, but the only way they succeed is if enough people don't participate, and they can dominate Congress, the state legislature, presidents and governors. And there will always be people like that will move in and take away from all of us and set everything up so they're getting most of the proceeds of society. And so the great rise in income inequality, Earl, that you've seen since the 1970s, it coincides with the demobilization of the American public. These are related. They are dependent variables, to use social scientific terms. One is related to the other in cause, and they're causal. In fact, the increased inequality caused people to be more demoralized, more hard-pressed just to make a living and afford the basics, and less likely to participate, leading to more power by the people just making sure that they get all the proceeds of American society.
So, Dr. Craig, it didn't happen in a vacuum. You and I'm going back to a time that you could kind of see what was transpiring with Republicans. When you talk about authoritarian, for those who don't know what that means, can you give us a definition of what that means?
There are a lot of different forms and flavors of authoritarianism, but it means
what we're experiencing, the one that we're experiencing.
At the highest level, it relates to power being in either one person, so that would be a dictatorship, right? Or in one group of people, that would be an aristocracy, right? Like all of the rich landowners, right? And there are combinations therein. What's developed in the post-Cold War era is something called what political scientists call a democratic autocracy, and that is it has the features of a democracy in that there are still elections, but the elections don't matter. So it's essentially an authoritarianism that looks like a democracy. That's Viktor Orban's Hungary, that's Erdogan's Turkey. That's India right now, for example.
Right.
They've set it up. So it is a form of authoritarianism. There's one strong man, but it has some of the legitimacy of democracy because people still think they're going and voting. And what it was like, we had this in Wisconsin the last 14 years, when the Republicans used redistricting in 2010 to set up the map so that in a 50-50 state, one party, their party, was guaranteed a supermajority in the state assembly and the state senate. That became an electoral autocracy. Okay, so that is probably what we're heading towards. And if you look at various Fox News commentators or other right wing commentators like Tucker Carlson, former Fox News, they love Hungary and so quite frankly, that is the model they're thinking about. They're not really thinking about going to something that looks like 1920s fascism, though they want to concentrate power just as much, but will have the appearance of democracy. So if they could gerrymander enough districts so the Republicans held Congress no matter what, then it would be an electoral autocracy, because it wouldn't matter what the people said or how big the margin was one part or the other, they would rule. That's what they're seeking. And you see them seeking it as early as 26. If Donald Trump is successful and can steal enough seats to make it so they win, even when they lose the election overwhelmingly, then it's no longer democracy, Earl.
So, Dr. Craig, while we're watching this, people are still voting and electing people. And shouldn't those people, the Republicans who are allowing this to happen, don't the people still have control because they have control over who their elected officials are? Even if they're Republicans and they voted for Republicans like Van Orden, and Van Orden is supporting the policies that are making it more impossible for even the people in their districts to live, isn't that the answer? I mean, you still can vote to remove those people. Is that still one of the things that why you can not throw in the towel?
Yes, you have that hypothetical possibility, but given
hypothetical
the level of polarization,
right,
which has been built up by the conservative movement deliberately, you have a lot of voters who so identify with, now I'm talking about the base of Donald Trump,
right,
that they are not open to consideration of actual facts is what's going on. Now, over time, maybe you can make them so, but the point is that where voting patterns are now and how you could manipulate the structures in order to make sure only one side could win, it has to take that it's allowed to take that into account. They're allowed to know that if they create a 60% Republican district in this country, it will elect a Republican reliably, even though theoretically those 60% would have the option of not doing so, but you don't have it. Used to be, and that is dangerous because for most of American history, there was a much larger group of people that would vote for either party, and therefore the performance mattered, and they were held accountable for performance. Republicans don't actually hold their elected officials accountable for performance. It's very interesting. There's been a lot of analysis of these rural districts that are overwhelmingly Republican across the country. They've elected people who don't give a darn about agriculture policy, don't know anything about it, and don't do anything on it, and it doesn't seem to matter. That tells you something's fundamentally broken. When people aren't even insisting that their elected officials actually look out for their way of life and their economic interests. So that's what we're seeing right now. But I think a lot of this, because they're not going to change, we have to make them lose, okay? So we have to think about us. And there are a lot of issues within the broader pro-democracy coalition, which is very, very, you know, pretty much lines with the Democratic Party right now, which is a very big tent party, is we've got to stop with the behaviors of elected officials that got us into this mess. And one of them is doing poll-tested talking points from consultants that were very safe and kind of promising people the moon with no intention of delivering the moon. So in this last election, in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City, and other places, they're saying, oh, well, the moderates, I would really say the establishment candidates, and the progressives, I would say more the, you know, the people who want to change the system dramatically, that would be Zora Mondami in New York, all ran on affordability, so they're the same. Well, they are if they're actually serious about making things more affordable, but I'm not sure that the establishment ones really are. They're talking about affordability. Are they willing to do the things that would actually make life more affordable and intervene against the major interests that control our housing and the unaffordability of housing, big utilities and the affordability of energy, healthcare? You have to take on the hospitals, big pharma, and the insurance companies, or are they just saying they're going to? The problem is that the moral has come from Democrats not delivering, because the crisis in democracy is not only the attack on its mechanisms, Earl, it's failure to deliver for average people.
So Dr. Craig, you and Citizen Action take on these kinds of what appeared to be David taking on Goliath kinds of realities. How are you able to mobilize and get people who clearly know it's an uphill slog to stay at the ready, to push back against, again, these insurmountable odds?
So we work on, we get involved to some degree in federal policy, but we have bigger impact on state policy. And our two big issue areas are healthcare, and we think healthcare is a right and a public good, not just a source of profit, right? And climate and energy, the cost of energy, the fact that we need to move rapidly towards a sustainable, you know, clean energy economy, or we risk runaway climate change, which is much worse than anything that's been experienced in human history. All entirely avoidable, Earl, but we have to like actually start acting and doing something, because the technology has gone faster than people think. The problem with the climate crisis right now is not the technology, it's the big corporate interests like utilities and fossil fuel that have co-opted the system and are trying to hold on to their profit independent of the good of the future of humanity in the near term, because this is happening quicker than we thought too, unfortunately. So we break it down, Earl, because we can't just say, we want Medicare for all immediately. as everyone has health care as a right, like they have Social Security, right, or Medicare, because we don't have the power to get that very quickly, and the state governments don't have enough money to do it right now. You need federal action. So we break it down into stages. So in health care, we have a number of bills we've been working on for a while that are major steps in that direction that would make health care more affordable, would take power away from insurance companies, hospitals, and pharmaceutical companies, and would be hard to pass, but are conceivable, say, if there's a new legislature in 2027. And so we have one called a Badger Care Public Option that doubles eligibility for Badger Care, but opens it up for people to buy into that instead of corporate insurance. If you buy your care on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, or if you're a small employer, only a third of small employers can even afford to provide coverage to their workers. It's so expensive for them. And then we have, similarly, in the climate area, we have a bill called the Climate Accountability Act that Supreme Moore Mukunde introduced in the Assembly and Chris Larson in the Senate, which has gotten a lot of attention, as 33 Democratic co-sponsors, that requires the state actually meet the Paris Accord requirement of cutting greenhouse emissions in half by 2030 in the next 5 years, and develop a plan to do so. And then yesterday, working with another bright young state representative, Darren Madison from Milwaukee, we just had a big climate lobby day where there were 150 people at the state capitol lobbying on the climate kind of lake, but also on a new bill that Representative Madison introduced in a big press conference yesterday at the state capitol with us and with our coalition partners, a number of coalition partners, and it caps the price of utilities. It says no one will pay more than 2% of their income for utilities, which is the affordable level for people, to also allow them to pay their rent, pay for health care, pay for food, pay for all the other basics. And so that got a whole lot of press attention and got a whole lot of people from districts lobbying their legislators to support it yesterday. So is that everything we need to do on the cost of energy or on the climate crisis? No, but they're major steps that are potentially achievable. And the key thing is people see progress. They see legislators standing with us. They see the bills introduced. They get the feeling of the victory of getting another co-sponsor, getting their legislator to co-sponsor it, right, when they're in a lobby meeting with them or their state senator. And so it's a process. You just need to start doing it. You don't win, to use a sports analogy, you don't win a football game in the beginning of the first quarter, but you know everything you do at the beginning of the game affects whether you're going to win or not. But then you got to build. Okay, you do well in the first 5 minutes of the game, you got to keep going. So we're really trying to do that earlier part of the game to set up for ultimate, much bigger victory.
You know, Dr. Craig, what is amazing to me about you and your group and how even in the face of adversity, you keep plugging away. I mean, because as you talk about clean energy and climate and those kinds of things, since the Republicans and Donald Trump got back in control and are controlling everything, they basically are trying to undo all the good work that has been done in moving forward, and yet even in the face of that, you still haven't stopped. You keep pushing forward. That's the kind of stick-to-itiveness that I'm talking about with your organization and others. You don't get frustrated. You just keep plugging away.
I mean, that's how teams are successful in sports, right?
Yes.
The Brewers aren't going to stop because they lost to the Dodgers, right?
Right.
Those guys are killers. They can't wait to get back and go at it again. That's what you need. Democracy needs the same kind of attitude. And the problem we're having is, you know, everything changes dramatically when there are communication revolutions. It was revolutionary to have a printing press.
Right.
People don't realize that you didn't have mass circulation of books until the printing press was invented. A lot of people think that was critical to having things like the Industrial Revolution in the first place. Certainly a lot of the things that happened in religion had to do with having, because the most popular book originally was in Europe was the Bible, so people could have their own Bible,
right,
and question authority, other people's interpretation. The telegraph in the mid-19th century was unbelievable. You could find out very quickly what happened hundreds of miles away, right? The newspapers in that era had extra editions with the newsboys running out extra, extra. Well, that was because something came over the telegraph and they were telling you something that could happen anywhere in the world, right? Within minutes in your town. That was unbelievable. You used to have, beginning of this country, the 18th century, you'd wait days to hear what happened in Washington, D.C. Okay, that's no longer the case. Obviously, the next big one was radio, then television, right? And it changed everything. Really, television started the process even more than radio of people disengaging, because before, the only reason you way you learn things is you went to meetings, and meetings have the potential for the meeting to decide to do something, right? You're engaged with people in a fundamental way. TV started to create a mass TV audience where they were watching TV, watching the news, and engaged less. Social media accelerated that. And so it's amazing to be able to, people feel like they're engaged in the political debates our day because they're engaged on social media, right? And that could help, you know, clarify how they believe, give them a lot of information, but it's not acting on the system. So people still need, we need to figure out, more people need to be willing to come back into the arena. Otherwise, the arena is taken over by the big interests that we know dominate our government because the public has receded, but they can't defeat the public if the public, enough of the public is mobilized. Not every single person, but just a lot more, because when that happens, because guess what, Earl? The most optimistic thing to say is that we have a majority. The people who dominate American government are a small minority, and they only have power because too many people have given their power away by stepping back.
So, Dr. Craig, with that in mind, so many people haven't given up their power and not realizing that the power is in the numbers, it's in the masses of the American people. Your organization and many organizations just like yours, those in power are aware of your organizations. They, I guess, feel they're kind of like fleas taking on an elephant. But the flea, if the flea takes on an elephant and enough fleas get in the elephant's snozzle or his ears, the fleas can eventually immobilize the elephant. Is it safe to say that?
Absolutely. In fact, the fact that engagement's been so low, Earl, I would say groups like ours, as National Council, have an outsized influence because they're not used to people being mobilized and holding them accountable. And this goes two ways. You have some kind of legislators that are thrilled by that because they want to get things done. And now they have allies, right? So I would include the legislators I've mentioned. They're introducing major bills that right. We've worked with them on. Senator Chris Larson, State Representative Supreme Moore Mukunde, State Representative Darren Madison. There were others at all the press conferences we've had. But, you know, we get word. I'm talking about among Democrats, some Democrats being very unhappy and thinking that we should just support their agenda, that they see the grassroots as some sort of support system for whatever they decide to do. That's not how civil democracy works. Civil society groups like us need to be independent and represent all the people that are volunteering and working and a common interest, and we side with elected officials who will work with us on that, and we push against those that don't want to do it, mostly because they don't want to offend those special interests, because those special interests fund a lot of campaigns and they have a lot of influence in the Capitol. And the way to develop a career is to get in with what they call the lobby corps. That is, those are the paid people that are there to represent the huge vested interests.
Dr. Craig, you use verbiage career. It's one of the problems I have many times with elected officials. That shouldn't be considered a career. And so when people look at it from the perspective of career, I've always said those people should be replaced. because if you look at it from the perspective of a career, then you've already lost, what it is and why people supposedly elected you in the first place. But I've seen over too many decades people who made it their careers, and somewhere along the way that they've kind of lost their way.
And I think I make a distinction, I think, between based on why you're doing it, right, and what you do. The career goes beyond elected office. You have a lot of elected officials that you've heard the revolving door.
Right, right.
Who then go in and cash in, work for a big industry, become their lobbyists because they have all the relationships with legislators. I'm not going to call A. Pickler out, but you can count a lot of quote-unquote liberal legislators that now work for these special interests and have cashed in, okay? And that tells you what they were about in the first place. Now, if they were elected officials and then they went into the nonprofit sector and just worked for a cause, that's totally different. Let's say Bernie Sanders, if Bernie Sanders had ever lost re-election, he probably goes and starts working on the issues he's been fighting for in the Senate and just sees it as it goes to another venue, right? He doesn't go to work for a big insurance company, right? And so that's what, and so I think it's fine if your vocation is to help people and to create a more effective democracy that delivers for average people, whether you're doing it from elected office or you're doing it from another place, either before or after elected office. So it's really about what is your motivation. But I think this, I have to hold on to this seat that my prestige, my ego is based on being a U.S. senator. That's why we have a gerontocracy where, you know, the average, did you hear what the average age was of the 8 senators that split with the rest of the Democratic Party?
No, I didn't, but I got to believe it got to be 75 and above.
78 is the average age of this group, okay? So that's a problem, but it's like, what? If for some of these folks, their whole identity is wrapped up in that office, and that's not how government was seen in the 19th century. It was very much more like people would go and serve a term or two and then go back to life in their communities, right? Now, therefore, there's a lot of new blood, there's a lot of turnover, and what that meant is the Congress much more reflected the views of average people, because what happens is your view of reality changes after a while for a lot of people who are in government too long. Not all of them. I mean, a Bernie Sanders, a Paul Wellstone, they were uncorruptible. But I'm saying that's a smaller subset of the group.
So Dr. Craig, for people who will be listening to this, who may not be politically astute and political science majors like Dr. Robert Craig, how can they get involved when we're talking about organizations like Citizen Action and they don't understand the inner workings of politics, which is very much, you know, complex? How is it still a place for the average American who doesn't understand the inner workings of all those things in your organization? Well, or did it all have to be political science majors?
No, not at all. The benefit of joining an organization like Citizen Action Wisconsin is you learn about the process. And you don't have to be the master strategist, because any more than a baseball player learns their position, right?
Right.
But they learn about the whole game, but they also, there are particular things to being a shortstop, right? Or being a catcher. And so we have groups of volunteers in our chapters around the state that work on issues or elections together with staff, with professional organizers, where we are working, figuring out how to do something, right? So it gives you a PhD in how politics actually works, because you become part of the story, right? We will know when we decide to try to push a particular piece of legislation at the local level, the state level, where people involved in that learn every step how it's going, if people are, if we are succeeding or not, and if not, who is against us and why. And you learn about the power of different big economic interests because they come into play, right, in the whole process. So it's actually a great way to learn about how everything works. How, I mean, we've been involved right now in trying to fight massive cuts to the bus service in the Milwaukee area. And it's a real eye-opener when people can understand that there we can try to push Milwaukee County on exactly how they're implementing cuts and how many bus lines at what point. But they're in fiscal crisis as a fiscal cliff because of the actions of state government. And so you have to understand, oh, this is about the state legislature terribly underfunding public transit. And this is a time when, did you know that 9% of people in the Milwaukee metro area don't have a car, of households, and for poor people, 30% don't have a car. So if you can't get anywhere by bus because you're cutting all the lines, I took a gentleman to the lobby day. I picked him up, who is legally blind, who has a job that accommodates his disability. Currently, his bus ride is a half hour. Okay, wow. So he has an hour commute, half hour each way, right? If they cut the bus line that's the closest to him, which is currently planned, he'll have an hour and a half commute each way. So 3 hours of commute.
Wow.
And so that is the kind of thing, and this is someone who obviously cannot drive because he is legally blind, but does see enough that he can get around, and he can ride on a bus, right? And he also can holds down a job that requires just the minimum of sight he does have.
You know, Dr. Craig, there's so much to be said about this, what you just talked about. I mean, it was looking at cut ahead, getting ready to raise the wheel tax $50 to $50. Many cities and towns across the state of Wisconsin, including in Milwaukee, in Milwaukee County, where it's over 30 some odd dollars. And at the root of all of it is the fact that they won't allow the autonomy of the cities and the towns themselves to do what's in the best interest of the citizens who live there. And so those are the things, is when you hear people say, oh, politics are local, those are the things that maybe you can really change, right?
Yeah. First, there's, you know, we have a, when you start to learn this, if you involve a group like Citizen Action, Wisconsin is unique in that local governments have very little funding authority compared to other places, compared to a Minnesota or a Chicago. So they're dependent on the state sharing money that the state, the theory of that was supposed to be and was for decades, that the state would do the taxation through a progressive income tax and then share it with local governments and school districts. Well, they stopped sharing it, but they didn't give people the authority to do it through different kind of taxes at home. Income tax is better because it's the most progressive. Sales taxes are regressive, but in terms of public transit, regional transportation authorities, obviously the economy is metro area, not just an individual city or an individual suburb. People work all over the place, right? They're banned in Wisconsin. In addition, because they're banned, there's no way to raise money. RTAs in Minneapolis or in Chicago also have the ability to charge property and sales taxes depending on the state. And so you can fund adequate bus and other kinds of mass transportation systems, not only bus. And Wisconsin, you can't do it. And then massive cuts are going on because they're underfunding public transit and overfunding highways, just for pure politics. So you begin to understand what's going on, what the source of the problem is, who can fix it. So the gentleman I picked up, I mentioned, the legally blind gentleman who came to our lobby day yesterday, very informed person. I mean, this is a lot of the people in disability groups, because what government services are the lifeline for them, right?
Right.
Are very active and engaged and understand things. He was not aware that it was mostly a state problem. So now he is trying to get all of his colleagues in the blind organizations organized to push on the state, because what you're talking about at the local level right now is managing the decline and the cuts. There's no ability to maintain or increase because the states put them in a funding box.
You know, Dr. Craig, it's those kinds of things, and I've talked with people in the city of Milwaukee who are terrified that their bus is going to be eliminated. It's how they get to work. You know, we're headed into, you know, these inclement weather, and so people whose buses have allowed them to have independence, that's going to be eliminated. And, you know, the cruelty of it, and the fact that you have a legislature that we have seen, you know, for a long time, just totally take control away and autonomy away from cities. And, I mean, and, you know, this goes back, you know, probably even a little bit before Governor Walker, but at the same time, Dr. Craig, it's why this gubernatorial election is so critically important, because you don't want to turn that back over to Scott Walker light. I mean, it's only been a short period of time that we've been able to have a respite from that. But, you know, in the twinkling of an eye, that can come back, and the power that they wielded under Scott Walker, if we are not careful, if we're not organized, that can return. Safe to say that?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen, we can see something like we're seeing at the federal level, and we've seen it in unparalleled cruelty. This isn't the first time, this last shutdown, Earl,
right,
where a president was trying to make it worse for political reasons, not trying to actually mitigate it and make it less impactful. It's very clear he was trying to, and still is trying, to cut food from people who need it, from families and kids, which is shocking. It's becoming evident that they're trying to break the airport system in order to put pressure on the Democrats, right? And obviously threatening to illegally fire all sorts of people, which the courts, because of the Supreme Court, are not addressing adequately. And so we have a party now that thinks that their role in government should be to break government.
You know,
of course, that's a recipe for ending democracy.
You know, Dr. Craig, we've only got a few minutes left. Time flies. But how can people get engaged in citizen action? What is the process?
You can engage on social media with us, because you'll see all sorts of actions we're taking all the time, and just come to something. So Facebook, especially Instagram. Our website is not only quite detailed and has action items, all the staff, all the organizers, all the senior staff, you would find there our phone numbers, our emails. So we're very much around, and you can just engage, just reach out by email and say you're interested in getting involved, or you can cut, if you hear something, come to something, or if you're at an event, you may see one of our organizers and our blue shirts. So there are just lots of ways, just reach out in some way or come to something, right? And then find out that there's a large number of different things you can work on. We're heavily involved in healthcare, climate, energy. We're one of the leaders in pushing for a $20 minimum wage, so that would give everyone a raise, just even people who make above that level or have their wages artificially suppressed. And then we're getting revved up for the elections. We have a grassroots endorser process for governor, for all the state legislative races, for Congress. And so there are lots of different ways to plug in, or just to try it and to see how it goes.
Or people can make a donation.
Yes, and you can do that on our website as well, quite easily. Yes, so sometimes, and we have people who are in cycles. Look, we understand. Sometimes people have time in the summer. Let's say you're a teacher, right? But you have no time during the school year, right? But you could volunteer when you can and pull back when you're not able, right? Or a lot of things happening in life. And some people who don't have the time but would like to support this will contribute money, absolutely, and because it takes money to run these organizations. And then get involved as they can, right? Or just take virtual actions, just sign petitions, just call your legislator. But maybe you don't have time for meetings right now, but. And everything helps, and we understand that life happens and people can be engaged sometime and have to pull back other times.
So Dr. Craig, we have to leave it there for now. Always great to talk to you, to have this conversation and dialogue. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Earl. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Dr. Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action, on what's going on with Earl Ingram.